All right, shall we resume, please? Page 291. What will transpire during Daniel's 70th seven? Daniel uses this expression, desolating abominable idol or abominable idol it makes desolate, three times in his book. Here, 11:31 and 12:11. In Daniel chapter 11, there is such a preciseness of fit with the history of what occurred in the history of Persia and Greece, particularly the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, king of Syria, and the idol that he placed in the Holy of Holies in the temple in June of 168 B.C. That's why I put that in that overview picture, because that's one of the references in Daniel to this Shekuts Meshomeim, this desolating, abominable idol. But that, of course, was fulfilled in 168 B.C. Christ says, when you therefore see, looking to the future, so it can't be that. It can't be Daniel chapter 11 that he's referring to. That's already taken place. He's looking to the future. That was in the past. Daniel 12:11. Now, it'd be interesting to go into that. We really don't have time to go into it. But it appears that this is a reference to the same thing as occurs in 9:27. That is somewhat mooted, but still, I suggest that in passing. Daniel 9:27 are concern, the construction is a little peculiar because it's plural. But of course, as I mentioned on page 287, there is a footnote in Kittel's Critical Apparatus. The Septuagint and Theodotion both have the singular. They attest Shekuts. So you have to make a choice now between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. I notice in some of the versions that they have made that choice. They have made that choice between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text. And they give the palm of victory many times to the Septuagint. Very interesting. That is at least the reading which I think is to be preferred here. That is the singular. Now, question. What are the major features? You have a chart here on 290, a diagram, 292, details of Daniel's 70th seven. Please excuse the figures and stuff. Now, if I put that beside page 293, one page beside the other, it helps a little to figure out the details of the picture or pictorial representation. Page 293, following feature, 6. A coming prince will make a strong covenant or firm treaty with the Jewish people for 1:7. Now, these are all things said in the text here. So that's represented by this document up there in the left hand, halfway up, with a seal on it. Under the terms of this treaty, the Jews will once again sacrifice in the temple in Jerusalem. That's supposed to be represented by this block there as an altar, and then the fire on it is supposed to represent sacrifice. I didn't make a Grecian architectural structure again. I got a little gun-shy of doing Grecian architecture for the Jewish temple, so I quit that. But in any case, you understand that's supposed to be standing in the temple. Now, this idea of a temple is intriguing, the third temple. And let's pause a moment and ask about that very issue. Who gave me these orange sheets? Somebody in this class or someone in the other class? No. Somebody gave me these orange sheets, so you can get some orange sheets. Please return those too. I like them. They're bright. I thought I could use them for intermediate, and I certainly can.
I hope this doesn't result in a great influx of colored sheets. But if it does, I'll welcome them.
Did you get them?
This is a photocopy from Encyclopedia Judaica. You might want to make a note of that. Who's still taking for people? Okay, John is taking for Junior. John? Sean?
Don.
Sean, no? And Don?
Yes.
No. Thanks, Fred. Running through it a bit quickly. Encyclopedia Judaica, Temple Mount. Notice on the page 988, well, it actually numbers the columns. See, it has two numbers on each page. 988 column gives the dimensions of the Temple Mount. Yesterday I saw somewhere that it comprises about 35 acres. So this property here is 5.17 acres on which we stand. So think of 35 acres. Pardon? About seven, yes. Notice column 989. The entire enclosure, line 3, consists of an esplanade or courtyard, two lines farther, surrounding an elevated platform 13 feet higher, decorated by arched structures around the central structure, the dome of the rock. In each of the walls, there are a number of gates. Some are blocked, some are newer, from the Arab conquest, 638 onward, which are still in service. 638! Wow. Within the area of the Temple Mount, there are about 100 different structures from various periods, including open Muslim prayer spots, some of them with small domes, arches, arched porticos, Muslim religious schools, minarets, and fountains, some for drinking, others for worshippers to wash their hands and feet before prayer. Underneath the present-day surface in the artificial parts of the mount, there are 34 cisterns. The largest of these holds 168,000 cubic feet. There are also other substructures, the largest of which is known as Solomon's Stables. The next page, by the way, gives a diagram of the Temple Mount and you can see what is listed there, or what is numbered there, is 15 and 21 down in the right-hand corner. 15 and 21. If you look on the next page, it gives you a key. 15 is Solomon's Stables. 21 is Mihrab of David. But Solomon's Stables are there. Back to 989, about the middle, 684 or 687, the Caliph Abd el-Malik began to build the Dome of the Rock. Three lines farther, this monumental piece of architecture of octagonal shape was completed in 690 to 91. Abd al-Malik built the Mosque of Al-Aqsa in about 700. Three lines farther, the present building was constructed in 1033. That's still pretty ancient. Column 990. The status of the Temple Mount after the destruction of the Temple. This raised a special halakhic problem. Halakha is Jewish oral law. Halakha. Or halakha. This raised a special halakhic problem, as can be gathered from most of the Talmudic sources. it appears that the most accepted view is that the sanctity of the temple site and of the other parts of the Temple Mount, according to their grades, and of Jerusalem as a whole, remained even after the destruction, after 70. Then, about three-quarters of the way down, 990, a secondary problem, not discussed, is to what extent the permission to enter, which applied in temple times, obtains after the destruction. It is held that, in general, there is no one who has not been rendered ritually unclean by direct or indirect contact with the dead. And there is no possibility of becoming cleansed, since there are no ashes of the red heifer, which are indispensable for such purification. So, no Jews are really rendered ritually clean, that is, sufficiently to go on the Temple Mount. The only Jews allowed on the Temple Mount are soldiers. Now, the Arabs are all over the Temple Mount, see? But the Jews, even though now the city is in Jewish hands, and has been, and Jerusalem is the capital, still they're not allowed on the Temple Mount because they're unclean ritually. Now, if you look at the next page and look at the Temple Mount diagram, it's very interesting that the question has been frequently raised, where was Solomon's temple? Where was the Solomonic temple? Well, a lot of people, frankly, put it right here, the Dome of the Rock. And they say that's where it was and that's where it has to be built, if it's going to be built. This is Al-Aqsa Mosque. And when you see the big pictures of Jerusalem, well, it depends, it could be little too, but when you see the pictures of Jerusalem, the picture postcard type, you're usually looking from the Mount of Olives down on the Temple Mount and the part of the old city behind it. And you see in the center generally a golden dome and over on the left a silver dome. Well, you're looking from this side. And this is the one that has the golden dome and this is the one that has the silver dome. The Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque. They're both carpeted, but the carpets are wet. And it's a nuisance because you have to take off your shoes. You're not allowed in unless you take your shoes off. And you go around getting wet socks, you know? You'd really be smarter, I guess, to take your socks off, you know, and walk around bare feet and then let your feet dry off afterward rather than get your socks wet and then put them back into shoes. But there are all kinds of shoes outside, you know? There's all these shoes. I guess if you're used to taking off your shoes and going into a home, then, you know, that's not so problematic. But I don't like wet socks. Anyway, the question is, where would you put a temple? I mean, would you have to knock down the Dome of the Rock? That's an ancient structure. It is a gorgeous structure, architecturally. It just makes people look. I mean, it's so beautiful. It's so well constructed. It's supposed to be constructed over Mount Moriah, and there's an outcropping of rock, and there's a little place where you can walk down into a cave underneath. And if it's on that tip of Mount Moriah, then purportedly that's where the temple should be built, over the place where Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac. But you notice, hey, there's a lot of room here. There's, in fact, a suggestion's been made that Solomon's temple didn't stand here, but here, somewhere around here, that is archaeological. But there's lots of room for a third temple without disturbing the holy places. As you know, the Constitution of Israel specifies that the holy places of Christians and Arabs are to be preserved inviolate. So you can't touch the holy places. Now, I think some Jewish zealots are hoping for an earthquake, so they won't have to touch the holy places, but that the whole structures will come down. And some Jewish zealots have tried to help it along with dynamite. But so far, they've been unsuccessful. Now, I'll mention that in a little. In fact, I have an article or two on that. This question of rebuilding the temple. Now, you remember the first temple was Solomon's temple. Before that, you have the tabernacle. Solomon's temple was destroyed. Destroyed when? Okay. So Solomon's temple is now destroyed. Now they build a second temple. And in 515, that's completed. Okay? Second temple really was a pale imitation of the first one. Now Herod comes along and builds a temple. Okay? Just prior to the time of Christ. Now you think, well, that must be the third temple. No. That was built on top of and included the second temple. So it's part of the second temple. It's considered the second temple. The third temple, therefore, is still future if it is to be built. So now, let me give you some other handouts. They're kind of interesting. Maybe I can have some help with this. Could you hand that out, Russ? Could I have somebody else to hand out this? And somebody else to hand out this? Let's take the one entitled Religion at the top. Judaism, should the temple be rebuilt? The bottom of the first column. This is from Time Magazine, June 30, 1967. You remember the significance of this date. Ron, what's the significance?
67 war.
Yeah, just after it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, just after the Six-Day War. The great medieval philosopher Maimonides, in his Code of Jewish Law, argued that every generation of Jews was obliged to rebuild the temple. Four lines farther. Since Maimonides' time, however, most rabbis have concluded that the restoration of the temple would have to wait till the coming of the Messiah. Next paragraph entitled Real Cohen's. Whether or not the building of a new temple should wait until the Messiah arrives, Jewish theology presents several obstacles to its construction. For one thing, the law requires that the temple be administered by Kohanim, priests. Six lines farther. For another, the Torah specifies that temple ritual include daily animal sacrifices, a concept alien to most modern Jews. An even greater obstacle is that the temple must be constructed on its original site. This could only be done by demolishing Islam's sacred Dome of the Rock. Three lines farther, devout Jews would be reluctant to destroy the shrine of another faith. Now the next one is entitled News from Israel, the right-hand side, the Jerusalem Great Synagogue is dedicated. Okay, this is the magazine From Mount Zion, which is the publication of the Institute of Holy Land Studies. It used to be called American Institute of Holy Land Studies. News from Israel. The Jerusalem Great Synagogue is dedicated. August 4th, 1982, dedication service was held for the Jerusalem Great Synagogue. About six lines farther. The idea for a central synagogue for Jerusalem was first set forth 60 years ago by the two chief rabbis of that period. To understand, there are always two chief rabbis. One is Ashkenazic, the other is Sephardic. There are always two chief rabbis. One Eastern, one Western, always. Dr. Morris Jaffe initiated and saw to the completion of this monumental project. Three lines farther. Besides being a place of prayer on the Sabbath, it will also be a place where Jews from all over the world can have weddings and bar mitzvahs. As one enters the building, there's a plaque which sums up the purpose for which the synagogue is dedicated. It reads, "This house of prayer for the Jews of the world dedicated by Sir Isaac and Lady Wilson to the memory of all those who died so that we, the Jewish people, may live. To the 6 million Jewish victims of the European Holocaust,
and all those Jewish men and women who sacrificed their lives in and for the defense of the state of Israel. Notice the building has an auditorium which seats 1,700 men, a balcony which seats 600 women. Notice still, women are kept distinct from men in the synagogue. The ark room in front of the sanctuary is large enough to house up to 15 Torah scrolls at one time. That's a pretty big ark room. That is when you consider how large the scrolls are. Notice, last paragraph. This synagogue is not the third temple. First, it's not located on the Temple Mount. Second, it's a synagogue. It's not a temple. All right. Next one, Target Temple Mount. If you look, you can see faintly the Jerusalem Post-International Edition, October 9th through 15, 1983, page 10, up at the top. It's very faint. Do you see that? Just to give you the source. One of my students gets the Jerusalem Post regularly, the international edition, so he keeps up on Jewish events and so forth. And he let me photocopy this article. That's why there's so many lines and things. Ultranationalist religious zealots have been pressing recently for a Jewish presence on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem's Old City, a site banned to Jews under Halakha, and the third holiest shrine in the Muslim religion. You understand, the first is Mecca, the second is Medina, and this is the third holiest shrine in Islam, the Temple Mount. So far, the government has resisted demands and ignored demonstrations seeking Jewish access to the mount. Skip down a paragraph. For the nationalists, three lines farther, a Jewish presence on the Temple Mount is the affirmation of Jewish sovereignty over all of Jerusalem and over all of the land of Israel. Two lines. Ascension to the Temple Mount for prayer is a way of hastening the arrival of the Messiah, who must arrive before the rebuilding of the temple can commence. Column 3, the first new paragraph. Since 1967, some religious groups have proposed that animal sacrifices be permitted again based on the halakhic statement that they may offer sacrifices although there is no temple. But this has been firmly rejected by the majority of scholars, and while study of sacrifice is underway at Yeshiva Torat HaKohanim, no sacrifice has yet been conducted. Last column, two-thirds of the way down. There are growing numbers of Christians, three lines, who see the construction of a third temple as the cornerstone of their beliefs. These are evangelical or Pentecostal Christians who believe that prophecies in the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament indicate that the building of the third temple and the Temple Mount is part of a divine plan leading up to the end of days. Though there's a clear divergence in religious belief between these Christians and Jews who work toward rebuilding the temple, they willingly and enthusiastically cooperate. Indeed, the Christians are encouraged by their leaders to contribute toward such groups as the Jerusalem Temple Foundation. The next one is entitled, Who Owns the Temple Mount? Newsweek, November 5th, 1984. The left column, about 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 lines down. Since Israeli paratroopers captured the hill in 1967, Israel has seen to it that Muslim holy places on the Temple Mount remain in Muslim hands. But Jewish religious extremists want to build a third temple, and they've begun a noisy campaign to seize control of the sacred hilltop. Second column, near the bottom. There have been at least 5 attempts to destroy the Islamic shrines on the mount since Israel captured the old city in 1967. Last January, that would have been 84. A night watchman scared off intruders placing sacks of explosives against the Dome of the Rock. Disaster also was averted by the capture last spring of members of a Jewish underground terrorist group. Three lines farther. The terrorists planned at one time to bomb the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque from the air. Shelved the idea only because they feared the explosions would damage the Western Wall, a relic of the Second Temple sacred to all Jews. Four lines farther. A Jewish college, recently established in the Muslim quarter of the Old City, trains 200 students in the rites prescribed for priests in the Third Temple, should it ever be built. Can you believe that? 200 students, about the size of this school. The next one. Time for a New Temple. That's 2 pages. And this, of course, is October 16, 1989, Time magazine. Well, this is a fascinating article. Some of you may have read the article already. Notice in the third column of the first page, next week, Israel's Ministry of Religious Affairs will sponsor a first ever conference of temple research to discuss whether contemporary Jews are obligated to rebuild. However, several small organizations in Jerusalem believe the question is settled. They're zealously making preparations for the new temple, in spite of the doctrinal obstacles and the certainty of provoking Muslim fury. These groups eschew violence, but offer no explanation of what should be done about the Muslim shrines that now occupy the holy ground. They point out that animal sacrifices and other aspects of temple worship are so ingrained in Judaism that they take up a third of the 613 biblical commandments, plus major portions of the Talmud and the daily ritual. Temple restoration is also a fixation for literal-minded Protestants who deem a new temple the precondition. Notice, next year an organizing convention will be held for those who believe themselves to be of priestly descent, the question of the Kohanim. Rabbi Shlomo Gorin, former chief rabbi, who heads another Temple Mount organization, believes his research has fixed the location of the ancient Holy of Holies so that Jews can enter the Mount without sacrilege. He insists, "I cannot leave this world without assuring that Jews will once again pray on the Mount." No group is more zealous than the Temple Institute of spiritual leader Rabbi Israel Ariel, who was one of the first Israeli paratroopers to reach the Mount in 1967. "Our task," states the Institute's American-born director, Zev Golan, "is to advance the cause of the temple and to prepare for its establishment, not just talk about it." Now notice, during 6 years of research, they've reconstructed 38 of the ritual implements. They'll do the other 65 as funds permit. A museum draws 10,000 visitors during the current holy days. Vestments, the whole thing. Of course, the big problem is the red heifer. So they're scouting Europe for heifer embryos that can be implanted so that they can have a red heifer, which then can purify. The last paragraph. Historian David Solomon insists that a new temple is essential. "It was the essence of our Jewish being, the unifying force of our people. The Temple Institute's Golan admits it may be a long time before the building rises. No one can say how, no one wants to do it by force. But sooner or later, in a week or in a century, it will be done. And we will be ready for it. Every day's delay is a stain on the nation." Very interesting. Temple. Here, in Daniel 9, 24 to 27, page 293, item 2, under the terms of this treaty, the Jews will once again sacrifice in the temple in Jerusalem, which implies the building of the third temple. Honestly, that last article, I would not have believed possible just 5 years ago. In terms of moving toward reinstitution of sacrifice, I would not have believed that possible. So they're searching out the Kohanim question, they're preparing implements for sacrifices, and they're looking to see if they can find or produce a red heifer. I personally think it's a matter of time. Three, after 3.5 years of the 7-year period, the prince will stop the Jewish sacrifices in the temple. Diagram, page 292. So no more fire is on that altar. And the treaty is broken. Four, in place of the Jewish sacrifices, the prince, now revealing himself in his true character, will set up an abominable idol in the temple, thus making the temple desolate. It's this outrageous and blatant act to which our Lord refers in the Olivet Discourse. The abomination of desolation continued to stand in the temple till the end of the 7-year period. During the second half of Daniel's 70th seven, there will be war and destruction and desolation. So So that time will be a time of great distress and trouble. Tom?
Can we determine that when the coming prince makes the treaty to allow sacrifice in the temple, did that presuppose that the temple exists? So that the temple will be rebuilt before the start of this treaty?
I'm going to address that, okay? So I'm going to hold off on that for just a little bit, because it ties in with a couple other things. At the end of the 77, the prince and his abominable idol that makes desolate will be destroyed in the outpouring of God's judgment. So I made a lot of cracks and knocked off the head of the idol. Now, this ties together the two passages, the Olivet Discourse, Daniel 9, 24 to 27. The abominable idol that makes the temple desolate, spoken of by our Lord in the second section of the Olivet Discourse, is the same as that which will be set up in the temple in the middle of Daniel's 70th seven. Our Lord said that this idol would mark the great tribulation, after which he would return to earth in power and great glory. So now we see a connection between the great tribulation and Daniel's 70th seven. And we see this abominable idol set up in the middle of Daniel's 70th seven. Question, who will it be that sets up this abomination, desolates? Daniel calls him the coming prince. He says he'll do certain things by which he may be recognized. The Lord doesn't state who he's going to be. But the question, of course, is who is he? Is he a ruler of the revived Roman Empire? A kind of united confederation of Europe, as some have suggested. And as some now see happening in the European common market and the development of that whole confederation. Is he a new world messiah, such as Benjamin Cream proclaim, who will offer himself to the world as savior from world starvation or nuclear holocaust? Both those things were mentioned in that newspaper article. Is he Satan incarnate, who will rule upon the earth during the second half of the 70th seven in diabolical imitation of Christ's millennial reign? Who is the personage? Well, here we stop, so we have to sort of say, who is he? Who is he? Next time we'll continue. And we'll look at these two other references, 2 Thessalonians 2 and Revelation 13, and try to get some further light on it. Questions? Comments? Ray?
I have the idea that the same way that after Christ's resurrection, until 70 A.D., sacrifice was still being offered. So you have, in a sense, Jewish people being willing from that. Acceptance of Christ,
yes,
as being the final sacrifice.
Yes.
So it seems that a similar thing is going to happen in the future, because generally the Jewish people have been unbelievers.
Yes.
So now this sacrifice is instituted again. See, it said in the article that they find repugnant the idea of animal sacrifice.
That's right.
So how much more
most
the sacrifice of a man? You know, that becomes even more of a stumbling block to a Jew today than it did then, because they did offer up animals. Whereas today they don't. So they offer up animals, and they get over that hump, and then the next hump is the once-for-all sacrifice of Christ.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting thought. Chris?
If it was rebuilt and sacrifice was reinstituted, how would we as Christians look at it?
Very good question. Very good question. Maybe we should do some thinking ahead of time. How would we look at it? Tom?
What is the plan they would rebuild it? Did they try to do it as the first temple described, or the temple of Ezekiel that never was built? Have they determined what plan they're going to follow?
I don't know, Tom. I think the Ezekiel temple would probably be too large, wouldn't it, for the Temple Mount area today? It's only 35 acres. The way the Ezekiel temple lays out the dimensions, it would probably be too large. The Temple Mount alone in the Ezekiel temple is huge compared to that little postage stamp, 35 acres. It's really small when you look at it.
So you would suggest that you go along lines of the first original temple?
Rebuild the Solomonic Temple? I don't know. Solomonic Temple, I think, would look small today. Quite frankly. I mean, the dimensions are not that large. I don't know that that's so awfully important. I think that if Jews tried to build a third temple, it would be a great building. I think it would be a very imposing structure.
What would they build? Just to their own design, whatever they thought would look nice? Would they try to follow the law?
I don't know. It depends who puts up the money. I hate to be cynical, but I mean, isn't that the way it usually goes? Isn't that the way it usually happens? I mean, the person who puts up the money calls the shots. I suspect there will be a lot of arguing, though, about the architecture. But I would venture to say it will be a beautiful building. I don't think, though, with today's conceptions of what constitutes greatness, that you could build a very tiny little structure and have it impress itself upon the minds of people worldwide. I don't mean you have to build a vehicle assembly building 50 stories high, as in Cape Canaveral. You don't have to do that. But I don't know. I think Chris's point is well taken, though. What should our attitude be if a third temple is built and if sacrifice is reinstituted? Right.
Why do we think we have to have an attitude about it? I would look at kind of this, well, we see prophecy being fulfilled, and you just really don't. You see a negative and a positive thing. You know, so the positive thing is that God can use this to bring them to their senses so that all Israel can be saved, as in Romans 11, that is referring to a remnant of the nation, which I think it is. Then in a sense, you
could
say, well, praise the Lord,
he's
going to work in this way.
Chris.
But will we not be decrying it as an imposter? It is certainly not legitimately real. And it will increase the gripe between Judaism and Christianity. It will not encourage us to draw closer. There is no possible way we could say that a sacrifice like that is legitimate.
But they offered sacrifice for a good 30 years after Christ had been resurrected. But God was merciful. He weaned the people from their concept. While the Jews have been offered sacrifices for hundreds of years. So how could all Israel be saved? It's a stumbling block while they were offering animals. How much more today?
Come.
Turn it around.
But the Christians didn't offer the sacrifice.
Well, there's a period of transition there. Okay, all right. Now that's important. All right.
You know, Chris is right. When he says that the new temple is built and they're offering sacrifice to begin with the sin, we have to cry out against it.
Okay.
Because there is the one sacrifice.
All right. If it denies, you mean Christ's finished sacrifice.
But the sacrifices before Christ came were always in relationship to Christ's sacrifice anyway.
Okay. You're doing it again, right? All right. There we must stop. That's funny. Extensively, no. Under providence and under the decrees of God, we touch on it, but really don't develop a doctrine of the will of God for personal individuals. Don't do that. The problem is, systematics is of such a nature that you're expected to cover everything.
Right.
And that's not really feasible.
So that makes a problem.
I don't know how to fix that problem, quite frankly. Okay. It's enough to try to cover what we can cover.
Right.